it came to the scene where Otello murders Desdemona. He really would kill her. Kathleen laughed and said, "You're a melodramatic old feller, aren't you?" Materia marveled. The girl was saucy. She deserved a good slap talking to her father like that, but never got one. Got a chuckle and a wink instead. Kathleen had a way of swaggering a little, even standing still, and especially when leaning against a piano. She didn't yet know how beautiful she was, but she'd begun to suspect. She'd begun to care about how she walked, to gauge her effect on others. She practiced world-weary expressions in front of the mirror. She looked up the word languid. She adopted a tone of amused scorn and loved to kid her father about his romantic obsession with la voce, ordering him to fetch her grapes and peel them, too. "If I'm going to be a diva, you'd better start treating me like one." He loved her way, acting casual, working like a Trojan, singing like an angel. Not angelically, the voice of an angel. Winged, lethal, close to the sun. When Malibran died too young, too fast. Sure, her voice went into her husband's violin. And pigs fly. She had the world by the tail. A modern girl. James had read about the new woman. That's what my daughter's going to be. One Friday afternoon in March 1912, while Materia is in the kitchen cooking a magnificent silent supper, and James is half entombed in the old piano, Kathleen appears in the archway of the front room. She's wearing her Holy Angels uniform. She's grown tall, leaning in the doorway, her weight on one hip, feeling her teens, though they're a year off. A smile plays about her mouth at the sight of her old dad, toiling over the strings of that decrepit warhorse. She glances down, bites her lip, then steals over to the piano and strikes a chord. James springs up and around. Though the hammers barely winged him, belts her with an open hand, then a closed fist, before he realizes who it is and what he's done, and how he'd never, not even Materia, though God knows. His daughter is crying. She's shocked. He's hurt her. How? With my own hands? Dear God! He reaches out, grazes a shoulder, an elbow, finds the small of her back, crushes her to him. He has never, would never do anything to hurt you. Rather die, cut off my arms. He feels so acutely what she feels, clasping her. Don't cry. A perishing empathy. Hush now. His throat scorched and taut. Shh. He must protect her from... He must shield her from... What? From all of it. From it all. A life and a warmth enter his body that he hasn't felt since... that he has rarely felt. She will be safe with him. I'll keep you safe, my darling. Oh, how he loves this girl. He holds her close. No harm. Never any harm. Her hair smells like the raw edge of spring. Her skin is the silk of a thousand spinning wheels, her breath so soft and fragrant. Milk and honey are beneath your tongue. Then he shocks himself. He lets her go and draws back abruptly so she will not notice what has happened to him. Sick. I must be sick. He leaves the room and bolts through the back door, across the yard, over the creek to the garden, where he calms down enough to vomit. Materia gets her balance in the archway where she stumbled just now, when James knocked her aside on his retreat. She came when she heard the commotion, and stopped in the doorway, and watched. She's still watching. She goes to her daughter. One of Kathleen's teeth is loose. She's young. It'll mend. There's a silly amount of blood on the carpet. Looks worse than it is. Materia takes Kathleen by the hand to the kitchen, where she washes her at the pump. She puts her to bed and brings her soft food, sings until the green eyes close, takes a pillow and places it gently over the sleeping face, but removes it the next instant. If Materia's heart were full, she'd know what to do, who to save, how. Loving the girl now seems like an easy task compared with protecting her. It's because I failed the first test that I am confronted with the second. Materia tries to think what to do, but thinking never helped in such a situation. She gets a whiff of salt air. A chill laps her cheek. She feels movement beneath her feet. The bed pitches, and she is on a liner bound for New York City, the girl with the heart of flame hair at her side clinging to the rail. But the moment flees before Materia can get hold of it. A message telegraphed weakly over a sagging distance of time and space, every second word missing. Materia knows now who sent Kathleen and why. It's her own fault God is forced to work in this way. Through my fault, through my fault, through my most grievous fault. Kathleen knew that her father had hit her by mistake, that he was terribly sorry. She knew he'd been working too hard, and all for her sake. No harm done. The tooth settled back into the gum. She made him a card to tell him she loved him. She wrote a funny poem about the lost cord. They put it behind them. The first solution. The next night, Materia conceived Mercedes. To her own surprise, Materia began to look forward to this child, not even caring if it was a boy. She was Hebla again, and she liked it this time. It made her feel close to her own mother, expanding body, avalanche breasts, slow thighs. Her troubles went into remission. James still didn't take her places, but he came alive again at night. She's my wife, after all. Her dark body and soft mind allowed him to enjoy her in an uncomplicated way. Why did he ever look to her for conversation or mental stimulation? It was unfair of him. A man looks elsewhere for those things. James finally felt normal. He put on a little weight. She fed him, ran his nightly bath, washed his back, licked his ear, and reached into the water. He let her. He was soothed. He had outrun the demon that had leaped up in him the day he hurt Kathleen. Materia tried to conceive in sorrow, telling herself that it was only to prevent a greater sin on her husband's part that she acted the harlot with him, enticing him even when she was already pregnant. Lust in marriage is the same as adultery. Adultery's a mortal sin. That's in the commandments. Materia prayed that God might overlook the impurity in her heart. For after all, her actions were correct. Mercedes is born late in 1912. Materia loves her. She doesn't have to try, she just does. It's a joyful mystery. Thank you, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, and all the saints. And God, too. Materia doesn't begrudge Mrs. Lvovitz a third son, Ralph, 2 months younger than Mercedes. Maybe they'll grow up to marry each other. James doesn't object or even comment when Materia gets Mercedes baptized by the priest at the Catholic church in nearby Lingen. She starts going to Mass again, not just Sunday, but every day. Holy water in the desert, she hadn't known how thirsty she'd been. Materia lights candles and kneels to pray with Mercedes in her arms at the base of the beautiful 8-foot Mary. But Materia doesn't look up. She looks straight into the ruby eyes of the grinning serpent dying under the Virgin's foot. Materia offers it a sacrifice. She will play only at church, and only from the hymnal. Her one concession is Mrs. Lvovitz's Yiddish songbook, which is the least she can do for a friend who has given so much. It's the same God, after all. 11 months later, Mrs. Lvovitz is on the spot again when Materia gives birth to Francis. Lucky thing, because Francis is set to walk out feet first. Mrs. Lvovitz reaches in and turns her around. Not so much difference between a calf and a child. Francis is born with the caul, an especially good omen for an island child, being a charm against drowning. Francis looks a little starveling, and she's bald as a post. Materia figures it's because she conceived too soon after Mercedes. The goodness in her womb hadn't yet been replenished, and her milk isn't as bountiful. All the more reason to love this one, too. Francis is baptized at the Empire Theater on Plummer Avenue, the temporary digs of the new Our Lady of Mount Carmel Catholic Church. Mercedes is a good baby, following everything closely with her brown eyes, sleeping when she ought, wanting to hold the cup and not spill a drop. Francis laughs at 7 weeks. Along with Francis, the town is officially born in 1913. The boom town has a name now. New Waterford. James feels the normal pride of a man with a growing family. He works double shifts, but that's a small price to pay. Those two babies are the proof. His demon is so far behind him now, he can reflect upon it. He was overworked. He hit his daughter by mistake and got terribly upset. In the ensuing panic, there was a physical accident, meaningless. Hanged men get hard-ons, for heaven's sake. Materia's pregnant again. James is glad to see that his wife has recovered her senses. No more roaming the shore, babbling. No more unnerving sights like that of his wife in the attic with her head in the hope chest, sound asleep or entranced. Never now does he hear her tormenting the piano as he comes up the walk from work. Crazy for religion, yes. But women are. And she'll get her shape back after the baby. The two little ones seem fine, Mercedes breastfeeding a dolly and cooing to Francis. Francis has hair now. Curly, golden locks, hazel eyes with glints of laughing green. First word, boo. It rains all winter. Plummer Avenue is aptly named and runs with mud, but the pipers have plenty of coal to burn off the damp. The fire is lit, and the radiators clank to life the moment Kathleen gets home from school. Materia watches Kathleen mount the stairs to her room, then returns to the kitchen and mixes flour and water for doughboys, while James washes up at the kitchen pump. She watches him head to the front room, already absorbed in his Halifax Herald. News from merry old England. The Union Jack has unfolded itself over 2 acres of new territory every time the clock has ticked since 1880. 5 minutes later, Materia wipes her hands on her apron and spot-checks James from the shadows of the front hall. Yes. He's safely settled in the wing-back chair beneath the reading lamp. Sozodont. Good for bad teeth, not bad for good teeth. Materia returns to the kitchen, where supper simmers and Mercedes rocks Francis in the cradle. She sets the table. 12 minutes later, she climbs the stairs to peer through the inch of doorway Kathleen has left open. The girl has a bad habit of lounging about in her underthings, draping herself over the side of her bed reading, wearing toe marks into the flocked wallpaper while brushing her hair, practicing different accents. Yes, she's alone. Materia silently pulls the door to, turns and descends all the way to the cellar to stoke the furnace. The house can never be hot enough for the orchid on the second floor. Once back in the kitchen, Materia fixes a honey lemon toddy and crosses again to the front hall. James now dozing in his chair, the paper slipped to the floor. Disgruntled Serbia. Continues upstairs, opens Kathleen's door.
Mother, can't you knock?
Hands the young lady her preprandial tonic and watches her sip from the steaming cup. A green vein shimmers beneath the surface of Kathleen's lily-white neck, summoned by the heat. Another glides from the crease at her armpit to disappear behind the genuine silk camisole. A flush spreads from her cheeks down her throat, splashing her chest. Materia lumbers back down to the kitchen, stirs the pot and hollers,
"Supper!"
James shakes off his nap and arrives at the table, rubbing his hands. "Something sure smells good." Materia yells again for Kathleen, who saunters in loosely wrapped in a kimono.
"Must you bellow? I'm right here."
Slouches into a chair.
"What are we having?"
Materia replies, "Boiled dinner?"
"Oh, boy," says James.
Kathleen groans. He laughs.
"It's good for you, old buddy. Put hair on your chest."
Kathleen winces. He's so corny. Real Cape Breton cuisine. Potatoes, turnips, cabbage, carrots, and if you're prosperous, plenty of pork hocks. If you've ever had it cooked right, your mouth waters at the thought. Materia continues to surpass herself in the kitchen. Everything she touches turns to juices. She hauls the pot to the table and ladles out big portions. Kathleen is English for the moment.
"No cabbage for me, thank you, mother dear. Je refuse."
James is amused. He watches Kathleen rearrange the food on her plate, and after a token interval, gets up and makes her a toasted cheese. Materia eats her own supper, then she eats Kathleen's, sopping up the broth with bread. James avoids looking at her, stooped over her plate, masticating slowly. He tries not to think it, but there it is. Bovine. Kathleen nibbles her cheese toast and leaves the crusts. The Princess and the Pea. If James has forgotten the demon, Materia hasn't. She saw it. It looked at her. She knows it's coming back. Materia has two real daughters now. She loves them, so it's all very clear. One novena gives way to another. She logs miles along the stations of the cross, meditates upon the mysteries, joyful, sorrowful, and glorious, of the rosary. Gains partial indulgences. Does not hope to gain a plenary indulgence, being never free from attachment to sin despite frequent confessions. The beautiful 8-foot Mary with her blue robe and sweet, sorrowful face has been moved from Lingen to New Waterford's newly built Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church. And there, in her own grotto, she presides with her holy infant and serpent. In the cool darkness, sweet chafing incense faint upon the air. Materia kneels at Our Lady's feet and prays that James be kept free of his demon for as long as possible. She prays to the demon and lights another candle for it. It's a freak spring. So hot, Materia can hardly move. She's huge. "What can be in there?" wonders James. Looks like she's incubating a 12-inch cannonball. Nonetheless, she walks to church every morning with her two children in Kathleen's old English pram. Mrs. McIsaac watches her inch by the drugstore window and worries for her. No one should be that close to God. Mr. McIsaac beckons her in for raspberry soda. Materia declines. Everything makes her queasy. But the little ones drink till they sport pink mustaches. The bigger she gets, the harder she prays. For James has once again ceased to come near her, and Kathleen grows lovelier and more careless every day. Materia watches their heads mutually inclined over a sum on a slate, sees Kathleen prance before him in her newest frock.
watches his face when the girl sings just for him. Swamped in flesh, Materia can't seem to get a clear, deep breath. By June, she's sleeping on the kitchen cot. No more stairs. This baby is sapping the life out of her. No more spot checks on her husband and daughter. Not at this rate. She hasn't a thing to fit her anymore, so she takes 3 old dresses and cuts them into one. Rosebud print in front, green taffeta sides and plaid back. She spends a comfortable day, but when James comes home, it's, "What in the name of God have you got on?" She asks him for money. She buys a remaindered bolt of crazy floral calico, and with the help of Mrs. Lvovitz, fashions 3 roomy dresses. Mrs. Lvovitz offers her several yards of pale blue muslin instead, but Materia declines. She likes the flowers. James shakes his head but doesn't comment. Materia's always murmuring these days, her lips constantly moving, whether she's mending a sock or changing a nappy. Worst, while making her glacial way through town to church.
"Don't be traipsing up Plummer Avenue, nattering to yourself, woman."
"I'm not talking to myself."
"Then who are you talking to?"
"Mary." "Jesus, Murphy." Materia sees the demon grinning at her again from the mouth of its furnace. Night and day, she secretes and spins a gauzy shroud of prayer in which she swaddles Kathleen. She sees the body of her daughter cocooned, suspended, green eyes open. But no one can spin forever, and cocoons must yield, whether to release a butterfly or a meal. What has she left to sacrifice? She offered up her music long ago. She would mortify her flesh, but that might harm her unborn child. She has no vanity left to mortify, so she offers up her fat, her shabby shifts, her curly hair gone thin. But the demon isn't satisfied. In the cool dark of Mount Carmel Church, Materia looks into the narrow green face of the serpent and makes the sign of the cross. Beside her kneels tiny Mercedes, little white-gloved hands folded around her very own rosary beads. Behind them, baby Francis crawls beneath the pews, trailing her dress in the dust, finding shiny things. Materia fixes on the serpent's red eyes and bargains. If the demon will limit itself to 1 daughter, Materia will allow it to have Kathleen when the time comes. The demon grins, agrees. Then Materia looks up into the serene alabaster face of Our Lady and asks her to slow the demon down. Materia recites the Memorare. "Remember, O most gracious Virgin Mary, that never was it known that anyone who fled to your protection, implored your help, or sought your intercession was left unaided. Inspired with this confidence, I fly unto you, O Virgin of Virgins, my Mother. To you I come. Before you I stand, sinful and sorrowful. O Mother of your Word incarnate, despise not my petitions, but in your mercy hear and answer me. Amen." Our Lady will think of something. Merciful are her ways. The Third Secret of Fatima. "I wonder," observed Emma, "whether well-educated Romanists really believe in all the strange miracles which are said to have been worked by their saints." Claudia, by A.L.O.E. July is sweltering. They've vegetables enough to feed an army. The scarecrow simmers in James's old pit boots and Materia's motley dress of rosebuds, taffeta, and plaid, the fedora angled on its blank head as always. If you've ever stuck your hand inside a haystack and pulled it out again, as though from a hot oven, then you know what straw can do. Peat heats up quietly. James waters the garden from the creek. Materia fills jar upon jar with preserves, labeling them Summer 1914.
James doesn't go to the baseball game on August 3rd, so he misses all the excitement of New Waterford's victory over Sydney, but he'll read about it on the front page of the Post next day. James has enough to keep himself busy, what with his job, the garden, and his daughter. That's why he doesn't go to ball games, or sit down to politics in front of McIsaac's store, or a deck of cards in back. In this way, he foils the efforts of most of New Waterford never to let him forget that once a scab, always a scab. James strolls up Plummer Avenue on his way to buy the paper. He no longer takes the cart, for why shouldn't he walk through this town? He lived here before there even was a town, before there was a coal company or a single miner. From a block away, you might think James was walking on water, but it's just the shimmer of the cinders. Nothing is stirring this afternoon, certainly not a breeze. Those who have not taken refuge at the shore sit motionless on their front stoops, feet in buckets of ice water. For once, it's a good day to be underground. James is dressed, as usual, like a gentleman. Only a beast or imperfectly civilized man reacts blindly to the vicissitudes of nature. Let the semi-literate masses strip to their undershirts, and behold the crux of their problem right there. So he strolls coolly into town, cucumber in a woolen suit. He buys the Post at McIsaac's, where a couple of old-timers sit blinking occasionally. McIsaac is sound asleep behind the cash. James drops his coins on the counter, and glancing at the headline as he leaves the store, can't suppress a pang of civic pride at his town's big baseball win. The old fellows watch him go, then break their wilted silence to speculate as to what qualifications might render a man insensible to scorching heat. At the corner of 7th Street, an old West Indian woman rings a bell, selling oranges from a hand cart. Atop her pyramid of fruit is set a sample of her wares split open, blood-red juices. James buys one. The sun has begun to set, the cool balm of evening coming on. Lilacs relax and the air is full of blue perfume. A dog barks, resurrected from the heat, and someone has struck up a strathspey on the fiddle, it being still too warm for a reel. James turns onto Water Street in time to see Leo Taylor pull up in front of the house in his buggy. Kathleen is home from her rehearsal. She waits while Taylor hops out and lets down the step for her. She descends from the buggy with the ease of a born aristocrat. Taylor says not a word, and neither does Kathleen. Nor does she look at him. It's moments like this that James savors. The sun basking in the west, blessing this island with rare rose and amber hues. It's all of life in a moment like this. God in his heaven and I in mine. Kathleen sees James and runs to him as though she were suddenly 7 years old again, breaking one spell to cast another. She's so excited, so nervous, I could puke. Some of the best singers puke before every show, James tells her. She laughs, delighted and disgusted, frisking him for the treat she knows he'll have. Got it, an orange hidden in the newspaper. She's been practicing for weeks. Tonight she will sing publicly before a paying audience for the first time. Just at the Lyceum in Sydney, just with amateurs and an audience of locals, but all the same, a performance is a performance. Always sing like you're at the Metropolitan Opera, says James. Sing like you're at La Scala, and never forget your public. They're not calling it a debut, but it is a first in its way, and they're both beside themselves with nerves. That night, the Orpheus Society of Sydney presents Elegant Special Scenery, Wonderful Mechanical Devices, Mysterious Electrical Effects, in a very meritorious production of Great Moments from Grand Opera.
Don Juan disappears in a blaze of flashpots, dragged to hell by a statue. Silence. Applause.
Bravo! Encore! Blow her sky high, bye!
The Lyceum is packed, standing room only. They've seen Tosca skewer Scarpia, then immediately leap into a void upstage. Seville has given way to Nagasaki. Women have sleepwalked, been entombed in Egypt and brown body paint, stabbed themselves on their wedding day, and gone mad. Just the high points. Intermission. Fans revolve in the vaulted ceiling, where leafy bowers and painted youths droop beside nymph-infested ponds. Below, spectators are happily abuzz as they unstick themselves from wooden seats and head for the lobby, where tea is served with date squares and little Union Jacks. James stays put, his face shiny with impatience and anxiety, his stomach half-turned by the past hour of grotesque huffing and straining on the tiny stage. Sister Saint Cecilia places a hand on his sleeve, but he doesn't notice. She rises and rustles off for a cuppa, thinking it's too bad and even a little odd that the girl's mother can't be here tonight. She had looked forward to meeting Mrs. Piper at last and congratulating her on such a talented daughter. James is feeling badly in need of air, but he's frozen in his seat. He has no wish to mingle and hear the effusions of the benighted throng. Kathleen is on after the intermission. Unseen by James, a dark little round woman with a gray bun slips into the back of the hall with a tall young black woman. Mrs. Mahmood is here because Benny made a delivery this morning. All these years, she has been able to resist waiting outside Holy Angels to get a look at Kathleen. She has managed never to send a note or a word via Benny to her daughter. But Mrs. Mahmood has come here tonight because she needs to hear her granddaughter sing. And Teresa, her maid, was happy to accompany her, enjoying, as she does, refined entertainment.
"Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats for the second act."
The audience rhubarbs back in, the upper crust of Sydney plus quite a few music lovers. The Sydney Symphonette tunes up. The house lights come down. The stage manager puts a taper to the footlights. The curtain rises. A courtyard, a midnight moon, a fountain, ivy and climbing roses, a cardboard cat with eyes that open and shut and one working paw. James is irritated. We're here for the music, not cheap theatrics. A man with a hump and a jester's hat of bells limps importantly onto the stage. The blood recedes from James's hands as he waits, every sinew in his body wrapped and wrought like the strings on the first violin. The orchestra sees her first. Then she appears from behind the painted jet of water. Incandescent. Kathleen. In a flowing white gown, her undone hair a halo of fire. James sits forward slightly. Stop, 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 everyone, and just look. Before you listen, you up there in the jingling hat, be still. Rigoletto cries, Filia! She flies into his arms. Mio padre! Father and daughter embrace. They weep, pledge their love. She asks what his real name is. I am your father, let that suffice. She asks who her mother was and what became of her. Con effusione. She died. Oh, father, what great sorrow, quanto dolor, can cause such bitter tears. But he can't tell her anything. He loves her too much, so much that he keeps her locked up here. You must never go out.
I go out only to church.
Good. So much that he'll put her in a bag and stab her by mistake. Horror! But that comes later.
for now. Quanto affetto, quale cure, che te mette mio padre. Lassù in cielo presso Dio, veglia un angel protettor.
With the first notes, a frisson runs through the house. Hairs spring to attention on napes of necks. Erectile tissues stir unbidden beneath pearl-studded shirt fronts and matronly bodices, and within the farthest folds of nuns' habits. Two things can inspire such a shiver: a beautiful voice and someone walking on your grave. But only the former can allow you to share the shiver with a packed house. As the song takes wing, the Lyceum disappears and the heat melts away. James cannot suppress his tears. At first, he's self-conscious. Then he notices other people are wiping their eyes. It's nothing to do with the words, which are in a foreign language, or the story, which most people don't know. It's because a real and beautiful voice delicately rends the chest, discovers the heart, and holds it beating against a stainless edge until you long to be pierced utterly. For the voice is everything you do not remember, everything you should not be able to live without, and yet, tragically, do.
Da noi toglie le sventure, da mia madre il priego santo, non fia mai divelto o franto, questo a voi diletto fior.
The cavatina comes to an end, a simple song. There is a silence in the hall, full of the peace that can follow music and allow you to forget for a moment your mortal enemies, flesh and time. The curtain falls. Applause. James releases Sister St. Cecilia's hand.
I'm sorry, sister.
She smiles, testing discreetly the harmony of 27 compressed bones. The baritone in the hunchback suit waddles out and bows deeply with all the humility of oat ham, but James pays him no mind. Here she comes. The applause soars.
Brava! Cries the crowd. Bravissima!
Atta girl!
The audience rises to its feet. She curtsies, poised, dignified. James has never been so proud. For all his boyhood ambition, he never could have dreamed of this, of her, a gift of such magnificence. She belongs to the world. She's almost gone. He knows that and does not begrudge it. He applauds with the rest. The baritone takes her hand, kisses it. Foolish lard-ass, get out of the way. Any second the stagehand will bring out the roses James has arranged. He can't wait to see her face. She's being pelted with daisies. James swivels in his chair, intending to spot the culprit, and instead looks straight into the eyes of his estranged mother-in-law. Teresa, the maid, sees the avid white face with the boy blue eyes and bird-of-prey bones and wonders, who is he to be staring at Mrs. Mahmood? Meantime, the boy who fired the daisies is running toward the stage, a black-haired scallywag barely out of knickerbockers. The house is still applauding. James turns to the front to see the boy vault onto the stage and kiss his daughter on the cheek. An uproar, a laugh, more applause. The youth turns pink, drops to his knees, laughing, worshipping. She knights him with a daisy. James is on his way down the aisle, going to put a stop to this when...
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your urgent attention, please?
Clanging a handbell at the back of the hall, it's Gray Mr. Foss, head of the Orpheus Society. James stops in his tracks halfway through the brass section. The roar of the crowd dies. All eyes are on Foss, who clears his narrow throat and with a reedy dignity befitting hope and glory, announces,
"The offices of the Sydney Post have just received a cable from the Provincial Parliament in Halifax. Today, Great Britain declared war on Germany. Canada will heed the call of the mother country in her hour of need. Ladies and gentlemen, we are at war.
2 minutes of silence will come 4 years later. But for now, it's a dotted quarter-note rest broken by the boy on stage, who springs to his feet con spirito, hurls 3 cheers into the air, followed by a handful of petals. The Sydney Symphonette strikes up God Save the King. The audience sings. James reaches for the lip of the stage to steady it, for it's suddenly gone a little lopsided. Late that night, 12 hours into the war, Kathleen sits at her vanity, brushing her hair before the big oval looking glass. She is not sleepy. How could she be? Tonight she sang, "The world will never be the same." Who is that in the glass? She sees herself for the first time. She doesn't require soft light, not at her age, not with her looks. So the effect of 3 candles is excessively ravishing. Her hair sparks at every brush stroke. The candlelight carves a grotto in the gloom around her. The mirror is a sacred pool. In it, she sees the future. Her lips swollen with kissing, eyes caressing. "Come with me to my home beneath the sea, and I will love you." She unbuttons her nightgown. "My beautiful throat." Bares a white shoulder. "Oh." Parts the fabric to reveal her breasts. "Sailor, take warning." Her image floating just beneath the twilight surface, tempting herself overboard. She hovers her hand above a nipple that gathers and pleats to a point, seeking heat. Kisses her palm with one eye on the mirror. Again, this time with her tongue. Experiments with the creation of cleavage. Arranges her hair, Gibson girl, milkmaid, madwoman, dryad. And leaves it there, spilling over her shoulders. It is a self-portrait, and the artist is in love. Her mother has warned her against gazing too long into a mirror. If you like too well what you see there, the devil will appear behind you. This has always worried Kathleen, in spite of the fact she knows it to be nonsense, so she has never lingered. But tonight she feels brazen, prepared to test the theory. She smiles at herself and gets stuck, can't move, can't look away or break the smile tightening to a grin on her face until she seems to be mocking herself. That's when she sees him, Pete, in the shadows behind her, his smooth stuffed head, his hat, his no ears, his no face. She whimpers. Pete watches. "Hello there." She can't find her voice. "Is this a dream?" In a wistful tone, "Hello, little girl." His no mouth, "Hello." She explodes from the sateen stool with a cry, flies blindly through the room, through Pete for all she knows, crashes out her door, across the hall, screaming like an incoming shell to the room where her father sleeps alone. She lands heavily on his bed, sobbing. "I want to sleep with you tonight." He's bolt upright, prepared to kill an intruder, but his fists turn to hands just in time to seize her shoulders. She's shaking. "Shh, shh, shh," he says. Carefully, through the darkness, he strokes her face. His thumb grazes her lips. "Hush now." His hand slips round the warm back of her neck. "Hush, my darling." He kisses her cheek, the warm scent of her. He gets out of bed. He takes her briskly by the hand. "Come on, me old son." Quick march down to the kitchen, on with the electric light. In her cot, Materia is already awake.
A bad dream, that's all. Go back to sleep, missus.
Hot milk with honey.
That'll fix you up, old buddy.
Kathleen sips and calms down while he reads the paper and Materia stares at the yellowing linoleum. She'll strip the wax tomorrow. Back upstairs, he drags her mattress into the nursery room, where Francis and Mercedes sleep curled in their crib. Kathleen looks down at her sisters and feels her first rush of love for them. Sweet bundles of baby's breath and milky dreams. She leans down to kiss them. When she rises, a lock of her hair is twined in Francis's fist. Gently, she opens the tiny hand and tucks it under the covers. Kathleen snuggles into her own bed on the floor and says to her father, "Don't go." James says,
"I'll be right here,"
and places his chair near the door, where he watches her till she falls asleep. Then he goes back to his own room and locks the door. The next day, James outsmarts the demon for the second time. He enlists. When James tells Materia that he has enlisted, she makes the sign of the cross.
"Oh, no," he thinks, and tells her firmly, "It's no good asking me not to go. I've already joined up."
She goes straight to church. James shakes his head. She might as well pray to the Kaiser for all the good it'll do. He's going. It's done. Materia arrives at Mount Carmel and hurries over to Mary's grotto. There, she prostrates herself as best she can, what with her unborn cargo, and gives thanks to Our Lady for sending the war. Moving picture. James decides it can't do any harm to carry a photo of Kathleen with him to the war. He gets one of Wheeler's boys to come out to New Waterford. He wants to remember her in her own home setting, not in a corpse-like tableau against a backdrop of faux antiquity. Lifelike, like her. After school, on August 7th, Wheeler's assistant arrives with his contraption piled in Leo Taylor's buggy, between himself and Kathleen.
"Set her up out here," says James, "in front of the house. It's such a beautiful day."
The photographer peers through the circle of his thumb and forefinger at Kathleen, standing motionless on the veranda with her hands folded and her feet in fifth position.
"That's lovely, Miss Piper. Just lovely."
As Taylor unloads the buggy, James comes up and tells him quietly,
"From now on, Taylor, any male passengers ride up front with you." "Yes, sir."
Taylor carries the boxy camera across the yard, its long hood trailing, like the severed head of a nun, thinks Kathleen, pleased with her own ghoulishness. The photographer arcs around her, finding just the right angle, as Taylor follows with the equipment. Kathleen is still in her Holy Angels uniform. James has told her not to bother changing.
"Beautiful. Now just hold that pose, Miss Piper."
The photographer spears the tripod into the earth and disappears under the camera skirts. Taylor tilts a large black card above the lens. Everyone waits. Kathleen doesn't move a muscle until snap.
"Miss Piper, I'm afraid I must ask you to remain still."
"Sorry, I didn't know you were going to take it."
"Do you need to stretch again?"
"No."
Kathleen folds her hands once more and smiles. The photographer cranks the lens for what seems like forever. Kathleen mutters out of the corner of her mouth,
"Take the picture,"
just as, snap.
"Miss Piper, please."
"Sorry, I'm sorry, I won't move this time."
Demure smile, eyes turning glassy, an eternity passes. Her mind wanders. She pictures the geography teacher, Sister Saint Monica, without her veil. Is she bald underneath? Do nuns go to the toilet? Kathleen scratches her nose just as, snap. The photographer pops his head out from under the hood. It's not a motion camera, Miss Piper. James catches Kathleen's eye and winks. She grins. The photographer huddles once more behind the camera. That's nice, Miss Piper. That's lovely. 1, 2, 3. James sneaks up behind the camera and pulls a cross-eyed face at Kathleen. She flops forward, hands on her knees, laughing into the camera. Daddy!
While at the same instant, Materia appears in the window behind her and waves. Snap!
Through the lens, Materia's hand fractures into light, framing Kathleen's blur of hair. Materia must be holding something shiny. I give up! The photographer collapses his tripod. You don't have to pay me, Mr. Piper, except for the film. I got exactly nothing. Print up the last one, Bai. I'll pay you. Leo Taylor packs the equipment back into his buggy. He's a bit surprised. He's never seen Mr. Piper anything but stern. Leo has always sensed something about Mr. Piper, the thing you sense about certain dogs. Best to avoid their eye. Don't make them nervous with sudden move. And yet here's Mr. Piper high-jinxing with his daughter just as though he were her brother or her beau. James and Kathleen are still laughing as the buggy rolls off in a cloud of sepia, and Materia raps on the window with the scissors. Supper, says James.
What are we having?
Kathleen asks. Steak and kidney pie.
Yuck.
He ruffles her head, and they go inside. Limbo. The child was not right from the start. First of all, it hardly cried. Made a sound like a little wet kitten. So maybe it was just as well. The tragic part was that neither Materia nor James nor even Mrs. Lvovitz knew to baptize it in time. How could they? There was nothing out and out wrong with it. It was even a big child. Full term, born the day after Kathleen got her picture taken. Did Materia weaken it when she prostrated herself at the plaster feet of Mary a few days ago? Seems fanciful to think so. And a tad blasphemous. No, it was a big child with a good strong heartbeat, and it lived 3 days, then died, no one knows why. Crib death. It just happens. Children stop. Why? It's a mystery. As though they arrive, look around with their little blind eyes, and decide not to stay. Materia had called it Lily, but it can't be said to have been truly named. It was unbaptized, and therefore no one, and therefore incinerated. James took it, wrapped in a sheet inside an orange crate. He was a little dazed, to the double company house on King Street that served as a hospital. Burial was not an option. Mourning was not an option. This was the other Lily, before the Lily who would live to be twice baptized, as though to make up for the first. Other Lily. What you do after a baby like this is get over it. Don't mope. It wasn't meant to be. Don't pray. Prayers don't reach limbo. Have faith. God had a reason. To test you, most likely. God never sends us more than we can bear. Offer it up. Keep in mind it was another girl. Materia gets on with it. Cleans the house in the night, bumping and scouring from pool to pool of kerosene light until the dawn reeks of lye and she begins to bake and bake and bake. Who's going to eat all this? She takes it over to the Lvovitzes. Abe and Rudy are teenagers now, big boys with bottomless stomachs. Materia loves to watch them eat. Beautiful, healthy boys, winking at their mother, towering over her, devoted to her. Good sons. Mercedes and Francis are disappointed, bewildered. Their new sister was there, and then she wasn't. Kathleen is angry. Babies shouldn't die.
Well, what was wrong with it?
We don't know, says James.
That's a stupid, rotten answer.
Life is sometimes rotten and stupid. James prides himself on always telling her the truth.
Not for me, it won't be.
No, not for you.
What upsets Kathleen most is the blank face on her mother.
A baby factory. Insensate.
My life will not be like that.
James doesn't dwell on it. He feels sorry for the thing, but it's just as well not to have another mouth to feed. And Materia has bounced back remarkably, like a heifer. He tries not to think it. Trouble is, she still looks pregnant. She'll be slim again by the time I get back from the war. But Materia will look pregnant from now on. People will always assume she's 6 or 7 months. This will come in handy. James joins the 94th Victoria Regiment Argyle Highlanders. His captain speaks Gaelic, as does 80% of the unit. James volunteers immediately for overseas duty, glad of any training that gets him away from home. Bayonet fighting at the Wellington Barracks in Halifax, rushing at bags bleeding sand.
Under and up, ladies! Under and up! You're caught in his rib cage!
A British sergeant teaches them how to dig immaculate trenches, neatly sandbagged.
Not too deep, lads. We ain't stopping long.
Just long enough for a bit of a kip. Then it's over the top with the Hun on the run. James is among the older men there. He doesn't fraternize, he doesn't care about King George, nor does he have anything against the Kaiser. He counts the days till he's overseas.
Under and up, ladies, under and up.
50 years of European peace have generated exuberance on all sides. A lot of horses stand ready to gallop across Europe in two directions. Cape Breton has joined up in droves, despite the fact that over the past 25 years, the Canadian Army has spent more time guarding the property of the Dominion Coal Company than it has fighting. But the recruiters have been eloquent.
Poor little Belgium, the bloodthirsty Boche.
The mines have been slow, and what boy doesn't long to be a soldier? The fact that friends will get to serve side by side is also very persuasive. Whole towns in the same stretch of trench. Everyone is afraid that she'll be all over by Christmas. James hopes the war will last 2 years. That way, Kathleen will be old enough to leave home when he returns. If he returns. James finishes basic training and takes up home defense duties. All through the fall, he and the rest of the 94th patrol the coast in a state of frustrated suspense, terribly worried lest the war should end before they get over there. They become known as the Blueberry Soldiers, because there's not a lot else for them to do besides pick blueberries and keep their eyes peeled for a German ghost ship. James eats at home, but sleeps with two other soldiers in a shack on the beach at Lingen.
Ready? Aye, ready.
Eventually, James is transferred to the Cape Breton Highlanders 85th Overseas Battalion of the Canadian Expeditionary Force. He is issued a Ross rifle. It's a good thing there's a knife attached to its barrel. No one knows yet just how far the Ross rifle's efficiency in a field of North American rabbits outstrips its performance in European mud. Along with 65 pounds of kit, James is also issued a khaki tunic, a leather battle kilt, a blonde and black horsehair sporran, a dress kilt of bright MacDonald tartan, and a beret with a red tassel. The Germans will be sure to see him coming. And with the regimental pipers first over the top, the Germans will be sure to hear them. Bagpipes have a liquefying effect on the bowels of the enemy, and bare knees in battle strike the fear of the fanatical. The Germans will come to call the Highland regiments die Damen von Helle. the ladies from hell. Finally, one day in December 1914, James stands in the drive while Taylor heaves his duffel bag into the buggy waiting to take him to the docks in Sydney. It's snowing, and James feels the unaccustomed bite of winter on his knees. He knows he is in the proud dress of his ancestors, but he sorely misses his trousers. Materia can't help but think how handsome he looks. James pats them all on the head. Francis tickles his knee. Mercedes offers him her soggy cookie. Kathleen throws her arms around him, can't stop herself crying. She never cries. She's not a sissy. She clings. He tries to disengage. "Be a good soldier now. Look after your mother."
"No."
"That's enough now. Shh, shh, shh." But she runs to the house, ramming open the door.
"Daddy, my daddy is going away. He might be killed or drowned before he even gets there."
Up the stairs, two at a time.
"And he's leaving me here with this horrible woman."
Into her room, avoiding the mirror, slamming the door, locking it. "Goodbye, fellas. Say a prayer for your old dad." He knows Materia will pray. She'll pray her fool head off. He's right. She does. She prays so hard that her head really does seem to get a little wobbly. She prays he'll be killed quickly and painlessly in Flanders. Over here. With James gone, Materia comes to life. She takes pleasure in her little ones. Mercedes is such a good girl, and Francis is a clown. Kathleen keeps up a life of her own, staying late at school to train with Sister Saint Cecilia, or to practice with the choir, solos, of course. When she's home, she's impossible. But at least she's out of harm's way, inshallah. What to feed her is a constant conundrum. Nothing satisfies. She rolls her eyes, sighs ostentatiously, flounces from the room. Materia falls back on James's old standby of toasted cheese, slicing it daintily into four, placing it before her.
"Saitan." "Mother, English, please."
Kathleen, Mercedes, and Francis share the impression that their mother doesn't speak much English. This didn't used to be true, but it has come somewhat to pass simply because Materia doesn't speak English much. For with whom would she converse in English? Not her husband. And Mrs. Lvovitz has always been mercifully undemanding of Materia in that regard, their friendship having revolved around food, children, and the old Yiddish songbook. Materia has been content just to sit at Mrs. Lvovitz's kitchen table and listen to the older woman hold forth on what's what. Prepositions were the first to fall away. Then adverbs crumbled, along with whole clauses, until Materia was left with only the most stolid verbs and nouns. The difference between Kathleen and the younger girls is that Materia speaks plenty with Mercedes and Francis, although she has lost some of her mother tongue, too, through disuse, all but the indelible language of her own earliest memories. Thus, Materia and her two younger daughters speak the Arabic of children, of food, endearments, and storytelling. Ya'a yini te berini. Mercedes and Francis understand that Arabic is something just between them and Mama. There are many Arabic speakers in Cape Breton by now, but the little sisters think that they and their mother are the only ones, outside the mysterious population of that far-off place called the Old Country. A place